The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Pete corners the market on fake IDs. Rand piles up a perfect record on brain surgery. Ron assures us that we aren't sure how sure we are, and ties it up with a tight knot. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Enterprise Leadership Network provides an intimate forum for C-level executives to gather and discuss key issues of the day. ELN is about building community, innovation, and collaboration with other ambitious, high-performing enterprise leaders through the exchange of ideas and information. You'll be able to participate in roundtable discussions, intimate in-person conferences, networking dinner events in your area, and a national forum. When you join Enterprise Leadership Network, you are welcomed into the fold of a private network of C-suite, senior executives, and accomplished VPs where you can build a solid network of peer relationships, carve out an executive career path, build your executive presence, and learn how to become a leadership and executive influencer. As an angel-to-exit portfolio company, other portfolio companies enjoy special privileges and access to ELN events. Take advantage of this unique opportunity to build relationships, grow your company, and affect positive change by attending and participating or sponsoring these outstanding networking events. To join other executives, become a member at ELN3.com today and grow your executive network.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on The Cyber Show. This week at the CES show in Las Vegas, new consumer electronics have pushed the limit with AI emerging as the powerhouse driving cyber innovation to the general public. With 1,200-plus startups and 4,000-plus companies, the 130,000 or so attendees are experiencing the sea change in the cyber world in a big way. And that's breaking news on The Cyber Show. How do we know we're being successful at The Cyber Show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. One, we know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. Two, we know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. Three, we know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. Four, we know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And five, we know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions, and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show, only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening. Cognitive Defense is an emerging company helping other companies defend against malicious influence operations. They do this by helping people better defend themselves against exploitation. You can get in touch with Cognitive Defense by going to cogdef.com, that's cogdef.com, or find them through their link at thecybershow.co.
Next Tuesday, Enterprise Leadership Network will hold its first executive forum of 2024 in Newport Beach, California. Meetings will cover electronic discovery, cybersecurity, and artificial intelligence, with executives from companies ranging from Fortune 500 to early-stage microbusinesses and individual consultants. This presents an opportunity to meet and exchange ideas with fellow executives in a friendly and intimate environment where you can share perspectives to help you become a better leader, make better decisions, and achieve better results. Members can attend for free. Sponsors gain unequaled access to what's happening now in their industries and to the thought processes of their customers, and we all gain knowledge from learning from each other. For tickets or further information, go to eln3.com and press join now.
Pete Herzog can best be characterized as a hacker. He's been a hacker since he was young. He's been on both sides of the line, between good and evil, if you will call it that. And his career has affected a lot of people, all the more so since he started working on open standards and Hacker High School. Here's Pete.
Welcome back, Pete. So, eventually you did graduate from college, right?
I did. And I have to say is that during that time, though, I mean, there were many times where I had a lot of access to computers. I was able to, I did a lot of nefarious things. I would make fake IDs. My first access to a Mac had PageMaker on it because
Macintosh,
right. I was working for the Institute for Gerontology, and I was helping with creating, I don't want to say news, it was news information for respite caregivers of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease patients. And when I wasn't laying those out and designing those things, I was using it to make fake IDs.
When you say fake IDs, let's be really clear what a fake ID is. You were producing essentially what got printed out as a piece of paper, and you might have sealed it in plastic to make it more realistic. That was a deception intended to cause somebody who looked at it to believe something about you that was not true. Or did you do it for other people?
I did it for other people.
Okay. So again, criminals were hiring you and taking advantage of your knowledge and expertise to perform presumably illegal acts. And well, but occasionally you probably also made an ID for yourself. So for example, you could go and have a beer at a local place that serves beer when you were underage, right?
Correct. Yes. Yeah.
And just to be clear, you're not the only person that's ever done that. In fact, probably, I would say, not the plurality, maybe the majority of all students at the college level who were underage in a place that allowed alcoholic beverages, only if you were of age, made phony IDs or got phony IDs from third parties for this very purpose, right? To have a beer or whatever. All right. So you and the majority of all college-aged and, probably people who weren't even in college made phony IDs to get beer.
So I not only made the IDs, I kind of cornered the market because near the college was a gas station supermarket where I had a job. And I had thoroughly investigated all my competition, what all the other IDs looked like. And so at this gas station, I was able to point out to management and everybody else what the fake IDs were and the real ones looked like, which were mine. And thereby only mine worked.
So you convinced them that the only real IDs were your fakes.
Right.
So you beat the competition in the market by educating the market towards your deception and away from theirs.
Yes.
This is now an influence operation, right? It's a cognitive attack. I think what we called it then was social engineering, right?
Back then, yes. And you have to understand that this was not a nice area. So this was there was probably a robbery two times a month at this store. There was a lot of drug dealing going on, mostly out of the taxis. This was not a nice area. We had some shooting, what they call the police call a shooting gallery in front of the store on the streets. So it wasn't a good area. I was probably the only white person there except for the management, the manager. It was just the main manager. And interesting place to be.
To be clear, you're not white, you're beige.
Yeah.
So you're the only beige person there. Well, you're a lighter shade of beige, right? Because we're all shades of beige, right?
Sure.
Brown, whatever. Okay. So did the ID making ever save you from somebody who came with a gun into the store? Tell us about how it saved your life.
So what saved my life was that this came up once while the district manager was visiting, and he was coming around to all the stores, and somebody had come, and I said that is a fake ID, and I would not sell them beer. And the district manager he took me to the side, and he said, "How do you know?" And I said, "Well, because I've studied them, because I've made IDs." And he asked me, "What does that look like?" And I showed him my ID. And I said, "This is one that I made. And this is exactly what they look like when you get them from the sheriff's department," because I had access to good graphic design computers. So this was not a cheap knockoff at all. This was actually done really well with high quality paper, you know, and I had done a good job. And he said
let me just explain what interrupt your story. When I did this, I always had a real ID that was legitimate. And if I made a fake, it was an attempt to copy the real one. So I could show the fake instead of the real one just to test the validity of the methodology, except when I was doing red teaming and I was authorized to make fake IDs that were actually fake IDs because I, you know, that wasn't my legitimate ID. All right. But so just to be clear, there is a way to do this, quote unquote, legitimately. However, that's not what you were doing.
Right.
You know, we've been talking to Pete for a while, and we know that you can try any opportunity to excuse what he does and say, well, no, but that was legitimate. But he'll say, no, no, it wasn't. And he's cornering the market. Right. Okay. So there are people that just make phony IDs and try and sell them. That's one thing. But here's an advanced criminal, right? He says, wait a minute. There's a business opportunity here. I'm going to wipe out my competition by training everybody to detect all of the fake IDs except mine. And it gets you to Humphrey Bogart in...
But think of all those poor refugees who must rot in this place if I didn't help them. Well, that's not so bad. Through ways of my own, I provide them with exit visas.
For a price, Ugarte. For a price.
But think of all the poor devils who can't meet a nose price. Why, I get it for them for half.
Is that so parasitic? I don't mind a parasite. I object to a cut-rate one.
Casablanca.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, we interview our friends and peers, and we talk about them. We talk about the industry and the people, right? You know, and this is another dynamic of an emergent area, right? You know, if you're going to be, if you have been successful in this field for the last, you know, 10, 20, 30 or more years, you're probably pretty competitive, right? You know, and it's, you can see it is an artifact, you know, of our friends, you know, sort of my age and up, right? You know, we all got here by being stubborn in one way or the other, right? And beating the other guy. Well, again, security is a competition, right? It's a competitive thing. You know, I am going to pit myself against you. You're the opposition. So it kind of shows up in all ways, doesn't it?
Yeah, heroes and villains.
Yep, good guys and bad guys.
Yeah,
and
on the other hand...
You justify the side you're on sometimes, but, you know, this is... You know, and again, you know, I did not have a particularly unlawful childhood. However, I got into places that I shouldn't have been, that I wasn't allowed to be in by deceiving the people responsible or the systems responsible and getting around them.
Hey, you know, I had beer when I was in college before I was 18 years old, and I think at that point, 21 was the age. But, you know, so phony IDs are such a common thing that, you know, it's almost not worth mentioning. But, you know, here's somebody who didn't just do it the normal way. He said, I'm going to go to the top of my field. I'm going to be a professional. I have a higher quality computer to generate these fakes, you know. And he's showing it off to his boss, right? You say, well, no, here's a fake and here's a real one from the sheriff's department, right? So you see, mine are really good. Now, here's their fake. Look, see, they don't have the seal right. You know, it's low quality paper.
Well, you're a magician, right? You know, I don't know if you know this out there in the world, but Fred Cohen is also a magician, right? And which is also not uncommon, picking locks, you know, in our industry. And you know, there's an Adventure Time Distant Lands, for those of you out there young enough or have kids young enough to notice that. It's this great episode because it's all wizards. Except this one wizard doesn't, you know, wants to do silly magic tricks, like actual tricks. Can do magic, wants to do tricks. And yeah, in the competitive world of security, you know, red teaming, I want to break into your things. It can be satisfying to find that you made a cryptological mistake or that I can find a port you have access to. But it can be more fun just to walk in right past you. You know, so much of this is
actually one of the problems I had in doing red teaming for companies. In that, you know, so, yeah, you do all that technical stuff and all the demonstrations. And all the demonstrations are these listings of, you know, 400,000 different this or that that I found, and here's something that could do that. But the walk in the door stuff is just so much more fun. But the other thing about the walk in the door stuff is that it takes, let's see, it's a personal fraud, right? It's an in-person, face-to-face. So there are a lot of people who are, they have no problem doing this online, but when you have to actually go into a social situation and behave in the manner you're supposed to behave in, they have problems. They chicken out, they get afraid. You can see it in their eyes, you can see it in their movements, their behaviors. They're not comfortable with lying to somebody face-to-face. They don't mind doing it online or something like that, but face-to-face lying, I don't know if I can handle that. And it's very similar to stage fright, right? And so there are people that, I think if you want to be good at it, one of the paths to being good at it is giving a lot of talks, right? So you have to go into a lot of places, a lot of different places, different cultures, and give talks and shake hands and smile at people and watch movies like Animal House, you know, Fred Cohen, glad to meet you. it's like that. Having the right attitude towards it. And we've done not recently, but earlier in my career, I did a lot of red teaming where we did physical entries into facilities, you know, large facilities, government facilities, private facilities that were supposedly secure, and you name it. You know, they're big data centers. And we would typically take a couple of people to do this. I think the biggest team, we had brought 8 people one time because I had a bunch of graduate students that were working that wanted to play. So, okay, no problem. So you teach them the basics of it, and some of them get caught, but mostly they get caught because, you know, they're like feeling guilty about doing it, or they're feeling uncomfortable about going here. They don't know how to look like you belong there. And the other thing is, you sort of have to be good at BS, right? So, you know, that's something, I guess, listening to us on the radio, you can tell that we're skilled.
Personally, I enjoy that sort of thing. You know, it's that thrill, right? You know, of you know, Stan. It's not the yet another difficult reference, but you know, it's the standing still. It's not the thrill of the chase. It's the standing still with a perfectly blank face, waiting for someone to react or not react to something. And in this context, you know, it's, you know, they're responsible for keeping you out. You know, you're red teaming, you know, let's keep it clean. You know, you're being paid by somebody else to red team and to attack their own facility. And you meet someone whose job is to keep people out, and you stand there silently while they, you know, to this example, you know, they look at, you know, to Pete's example, the physical piece of ID that you manufactured, you know, that isn't real. And they're holding it in their hand. They're looking at it, right? I love that sort of stuff, right? No, it's, you know, hacking at its finest, right? Your hacking is not about finding open ports. You say red teaming, God bless all my friends who make a living doing this stuff. And yeah, if it's a wake up call, it's great, but you're not going to fix 400,000 things. Because I'll tell you right now, there's so many ways in your company that, you know, you'll never list them all, right? The true essence of hacking is looking at something and understanding how it works, how the people work, what they're trying to do. And again, that ultimate test for me is to be able to stand right there and say, here it is, and have the door open wide and walk right through. You know, that's when you know you understand something well enough.
So I'm trying to think through it. It's been a long, long time, if it was ever true, that I got a thrill out of that activity. It was, maybe there's some, I don't know, it's just very strange. When I think about those activities, when I used to do them, it was not the thrill of that encounter, because I knew that encounter would work the way it worked. It was the thinking, the thought process, you know, getting your mind up to speed to where in the time frame necessary, you can make the right decision. Everything is about timing in those situations, right? Find the right place to go into that line between those two people. Find the right, you know, group of people that looks like what you look like. Find the right restaurant. You know, it's all find the right. So that thought process, that cranking up the speed of your brain to get it right, that's sort of the most interesting part. And the other really interesting part is thinking of new ways to get around, you know, even these complex security situations. You know, all right, you cannot get in without a badge. I mean, you just The mechanism is designed so you need a badge and you don't have a legitimate badge. So how do you get one? Well, of course, you have to borrow one. And I use that term appropriately because we do return them, because otherwise when the person came back to work, it would not have been returned and they would have not had their badge and somebody would have noticed. So how do you get the badge from them, use it for the right amount of time, get back to them and put it back on their person without them knowing it so nobody misses it, right? Now it's getting more interesting.
Well,
so that, to me, it's more that the exercise than the exercise of, oh, I got them, you know?
Well, you had said you want to get good at this, do a lot of public speaking. And it's one of my, it's a little more recent than some of the other ones. Maybe that's why I think it's one of my favorites. But anyways, one of my favorite talks a couple of years ago, and I was in Cartagena, Colombia. And I got 800 top executives from this large organization at their big, biannual get together. And I was really getting into my talk at a keynote first thing in the morning. At the whole room there, everybody's got, multiple language translation, earbuds all over the place, very formal. And I got a huge monitor down on the floor for a timer. And I just really getting into my talk, and I flipped up the last slide and looked for the first time at the countdown timer, and I had 20 minutes left, and I just pulled up my last slide. And as you say, so I'm thinking, all right, I'm speaking, I'm thinking at the same time. I gotta fill up 20 minutes here, and it's gotta be good. Right? You can't just be fluff. And I turned it into a Q&A, and I walk back and forth on the stage, gesturing to the microphone runners, to get him to go to a certain executive that I met the day before, and weaving into my words, to get him interested in responding and engaging, and it worked well. It was a great thing. But it was, again, that same sort of thing where fooling people, I guess we'll just say it that way, we're speaking contemporaneously, but as far as anybody there knew, I had planned this 20-minute Q&A. It was very engaging and we built on the conversation. I did not. I made that up right there. And that's the fun of security. As you say, when you're standing right there, right, you're thinking it through, doing it live, live response, flip the tables on this, the PSIR, products, security, incident response teams. I've been involved with those. When something bad happens to you or one of your customers in real time, and you end up with this, part of this global team that's staying awake all night, what does it say about a military life is, 99% boredom, and then 1% terror. Cybersecurity is not a, even detective jobs are not, movies. However, they do lead to these moments that are just very much live and real. I love that.
So when you mentioned that, you're dancing, right? It's basically like, you have to dance your way through it, right? So it used to be at the Computer Security Institute. And I liked conferences the way they were before the field became so large and popular. Okay, so you go to the RSA conference, it's like hundreds of thousands, might only be 50,000 people. What the heck of a lot of people, right? So everything's all planned out, and you have to show your presentation in advance. They have to review it, and you're an accepted presenter, and you've gotten in a number of these things. But back in Computer Security Institute, way back when, I used to go, and people would not get there for their talk, and so there'd be an open slot for a talk with the subject. And an outline, an overview of what the talk, so it has a name of the talk and it's got like a paragraph. And so, I used to be one of the folks that they would say, oh, we need somebody to give this talk. And I'd say, what's it about? All right, I can do that. No problem. When does it start? 5 minutes from now. Okay. No problem. I'll go in and give a talk. And I'll even have some slides that are relevant, because I have some slides from somewhere else. I'll bring them up. And
you have 10 minutes, plenty of time to shuffle them, right? And edit the title.
Well, it's not just that. It's that the topics, so one of the things that I have is methodologies, right? A lot of people have a lot of facts and a lot of minutia, and they go through minutia. And I have methodologies. I have approaches that I take to doing things that are systematic with the goal of being comprehensive. And so when you have methodologies, you can just bring a methodology, apply it to the particular topic, and it makes a lot of sense. You can go through it in a systematic way. And if you have a lot of know-how about the details, you can bring in details. And you don't have to bring in every detail everywhere because you don't have that much time. But again, that's the same thing, right? That's that that real-time interaction. And you're completely right that security, cybersecurity for sure, is about attack and defense. It is a game with two opposing parties, and I've always been a defender, right? So yeah, I know how to red team, I know how to attack stuff, but I'm a defender. My job is to defend, right? So and yet I seem to be good at attacking, whereas most of the attackers I meet are no good at defending.
Frankly, most of them aren't that good at attacking either. The good ones, of course, are really good. But and again, this is why I think that goodness, by some word, is an evolutionary trait, right? You know, it's hard to get really, really good people to put in that kind of dedication that, you know, Pete has and Ron Ross and Tom Johnson, all those people, for something nefarious. You know, you want to put your heart and soul into it, be really good. You want to really compete. You know, you need Ted Lasso as a coach, right? Not Vladimir Putin.
I think he's awfully good at what he does, but we can discuss that another time. We're going to move on to the next subject.
Cognitive Defense is an emerging company helping other companies defend against malicious influence operations. They do this by helping people better defend themselves against exploitation. You can get in touch with Cognitive Defense by going to cogdef.com. That's cogdef.com, or find them through their link at thecybershow.co. We're talking with Rand Waltzman, who has a long history in the cybersecurity and artificial intelligence arena, and perhaps most importantly in the deception, counter-deception, influence operations, counter-influence operations, and related areas. Here is Rand.
We're back with Rand, and now that you are unable to make the machine think, what's your next experience with computers after that?
Let's see. The next experience, I worked there were some guys in the high energy physics lab. So one of the jobs I had there was scanning bubble chamber photographs. You know, when you do a high energy physics experiment in a particle accelerator, you know, they used to have in those days things called bubble chambers. And what happens is the particles tore through these bubble chambers, they left a trail of vapor bubbles. That's how you saw where they went. And so you would take pictures of the reactions, you know, when the particles got there and did what kind of reaction we were looking for. And they could take like a million pictures out of from one experiment. So then somebody had to actually digitize these pictures. And in those days, the digitization was done by hand. And the way it worked was they had these film, they were on big rolls, and the rolls were spooled up over a light table. And so each frame was projected onto the light table, and on the light table was an XY runner. And they told you how to pick out the tracks that looked interesting. And then you took this runner and you ran them, you know, you picked out four or five, you know, positions, and you punched this thing, you know, and it recorded the coordinates. And that's how the tracks were digitized.
Oh my goodness. Okay. So now the nuclear physics lab at the University of Pittsburgh, where I was at about that time frame, they were doing accelerators.
Yeah.
But they took pictures, but they also had a bunch of sensors, right? So you had a whole bunch of sensors around the place. Each sensor would produce analog output, and then they would do analog to digital converters so you could actually get the sensor data. And then for the pictures, we actually took a camera, a digital camera, which was pretty early at that time. But we took a digital camera and tried to do the analysis of the pixels. So that was probably much easier and more automated than you manually going and saying, "Oh, here and here and here."
Well, now it's all automated. Now nobody touches anything. I mean, of course, right?
Well,
and now you have digital cameras. Those guys didn't have digital. I don't think these were digital cameras that they had.
Well, no, but there were digital cameras at that time, but they were more like sensor arrays, right? So you'd get a light sense transistors. You know, so you have an array of sensing transistors, and they would trigger, and you would, you know, collect the voltages on them at a given moment in time. And, you know, it wasn't exactly at one moment in time because it took a while to scan it.
Well, I think there was another thing that worked a little bit more like that. Instead of a bubble chamber, there was, I think it was called a spark chamber.
Oh, more exciting.
And I think the way it worked, you know, I'm talking about, you know, more than 50 years ago now, right? But I think what it was is like a grid in space. And as the things went, as the particles tore through, they actually set off sparks on these grids. So I think
you had an XY coordinate, sure.
Yes. So they had XY and Z coordinates they had. So
there you go. Three dimensional grid.
Yeah.
All right.
Because there were planes.
But that was a data entry job.
Yeah. Right. Well, and then I ran the programs to analyze the data.
Okay. And so did that work out or did you, yes, again?
Oh, okay. No. Because those programs were written, and you know, this was already done. It was a question of just running them to analyze the data. So it's just running the things. So.
There you go.
So that,
all right.
So that worked out just fine. And yeah. And then what else was I doing? Well, I did a few more jobs, some similar kinds of things.
Yeah, that was why you were going to school?
While I was going to school, yeah. But the best job I had, of course, had nothing to do with computers. One afternoon, I worked as a brain surgeon. That was really fun.
So tell me about the brain surgery.
Yes. So there was this an elderly couple. They were both biologists at Caltech. They were very famous people. And they did experiments on rats. So they had thousands of these rats, right? And the way the experiments that they did involved, so you have to insert like a plug into the head, a socket into the head of the rat. And then they could plug the rat in, and then the rat ran around and did things, you know, and they could make direct measurements from the brain from this plug. So it was the rat became, they like tethered the rat to a wire and with this plug. So the operations were to actually insert these plugs into their heads, into the brain. So you had these little tiny operating tables. And what you were supposed to do, so they demonstrated to me the first, you know, how you did this. So she picked up the rat and she held it by its forearms. And you gave it a shot of something. I don't remember what the something was, but it was supposed to put it to sleep. And then you laid it out on this little operating table. And you made an incision across the skull. And when you made the incision, there was some kind of anticoagulant that you dabbed on so that you could stop the blood. And then you had like a little tiny drill press where you drilled like three holes in a special place. No. And then you lowered this with the wires into the brain. And then you were supposed to sew up the skin around the plug, right? And of course, the idea was that the rat should be alive afterwards because it was supposed to be running around.
So
she says, okay, now you try. So I tried I took the first rat, I gave it, and she walked away. And I gave it a shot. It was a big rat. And it was running around and running around. I said, I don't know, it's not going down. Maybe I'll give it another shot, right? So I gave it another shot. No effect. Rat is still running around and running around. I said, all right, I'll give it one more shot. I give it one more shot. The thing finally went down. So I called her over. I said, yeah, look, I finally got the thing down. It looks, it looks pretty still. So she looked at it. She said, well, I don't know. She was a German. And she said, I don't know how to tell you this, but the rat is dead. Are you kidding? I said, fine. So she said, okay, try another one. So
you lost your first patient. So
lost my first patient.
Back on the table. Yeah, let's go.
First time out, right? So she walks by, I grab another one. I give it a shot, and it didn't go down. I said, all right, I'm going to give it one more. I won't give it three. I'll give it one more and see what happens. So I give it one more, and finally it goes down. And this time I could see that it was breathing. So I put it on the table. I did the incision. And then I dabbed this coagulant on, and the blood stopped with like a miracle, like magic. And I called her over. I said, hey, listen, look, this stuff really works. It's fantastic. So she looks at it, and she looks at the rat, and she says, well, I don't know how to tell you this, my boy, but the rat just died.
Oh no!
So
that's over too. But the third time's the charm, right?
Yeah. So shortly after that, I was. She comes over to me. And she says, "Well, my boy, perhaps this kind of work is not for you." And I was fired. So my one afternoon as a brain surgeon. Yes.
Hey, but you have a perfect record.
Yeah, why spoil it, right?
Oh, man. So, but these are true cybernetic systems.
Oh, yes.
Absolutely. All right. So, okay. So what do you think? A perfect record as a brain surgeon?
Right. I tell you, in coming years, there are going to be a lot of movies made about these stories, right? You know, this is a... You know, I'm a big fan of, you know, give me, you know, World War II documentaries, you know, or historical recreations, Alan Turing and all that. It's just a hoot, you know, and it's my pleasure to be around during this period when I can hear all these stories and take part in some of them, because it's all madness. It's just great.
So, Grandpa, how did you become a computer scientist? Well, first I was a brain surgeon, but they all died. You know, the path of early experimentation. I mean, you know, this guy Rand was, you know, really at a beginning of all sorts of fantastic things, and he was moving from one thing to another in different labs, doing different sorts of, you know, experimental work. And it's sort of fascinating. I mean, look, this 2D table where, you know, this is a plotter, you know, a plotter, a 2D plotter has a bar going across and a bar going up. And at the intersection, there's a pen and the motors turn in two dimensions. And then the pen goes down and you move the motors to move the pen around. And then you lift up the pen, right? You can do it for multiple colors. Although usually you do it by changing pens for the second color in the cheaper ones like this. So that was the output version. The input version, you would do, it's the same machine. You just move stuff around and the motors would click off and tell you where you were. And then you'd push the button that says, I'm here. So now imagine you have pictures, you know, you're talking about a millisecond, 1,000 pictures a second. Thousands of pictures a second, and by hand, he is moving this 3D. Oh, there's one. Push the button. Move it somewhere up there. That's it. 5 for this one. Okay. Move the thing over. Take the sheet out. Put the next one there. Go do it again. 1,000 times a second or more.
I mean, folks, you got to remember how short history was, right? You know, everybody's probably heard of the Royal Society, the British Royal Society, you know, started in the late 1600s. By folks like Christopher Wren and Isaac Newton and so forth. And this was the height of, and it's still today, you know, an amazing organization. But, you know, among those founding members, Christopher Wren would do things like, see what happens when you filled a living dog full of water. Because nobody had done that before, right? And map onto that, you know, 350 years sounds like a long time, but you've seen the chart, you know, this exponential growth chart. You know, we've learned more in the last 50 years than we have in the last 9 billion or whatever. So almost all of the knowledge we have has been gathered within the span of the oldest living human today.
You know, you go starting back with these mechanisms. Starting with these mechanisms, right?
So literally starting with these mechanisms. What do you do? You do it. Do it once. Do it again. Document it. You know, keep going.
So B.R. Tier. Okay. B.R. Tier was a professor at Carnegie Mellon when I was a undergraduate student there, and he was my first class. He taught my first class in the electrical engineering program there. And the first thing we did was measurement theory, where you learn that everything you do to measure something interferes with the thing you're measuring with. And in the beginning of this, he told us the story of when he was young, because at this point he was, you know, pretty old, but when he was young, and they wanted to measure voltage, what they would do is go down to the creek
in Panther Hollow.
So there's a creek. This is at Hammerschlag Hall at Carnegie Mellon University. There's a creek in a ravine right behind it. And they would go down to the creek and pick up frogs from the creek. They would bring the frog up and they would, kill the frog, put a pin through its neck or whatever, kill the frog. But it was still, you know, sort of technically still moving and such. And what they would do is put voltages across the legs and see how far up the legs moved. And that's how they measured voltage. So the voltmeter with the wire wrapped around the magnet was a big move forward from the, you know, from the frog legs moving. But nowadays, you know, the modern sensors, of course, are fantastically accurate. And, you know, just the simplest little, you know, handheld device will do a time measurement of a value, you know, whereas, I mean, even when I was in school, you know, a voltmeter was a thing with an arm that moved back and forth, and you could sort of look at it and get maybe a digit or two of accuracy. Now they'll get you 6 or 7 digits of accuracy and a time map and do, you know, convolutions and so forth on it. That advance of technology it's stupendous to watch, but it's also, I don't know how to reflect the joy that I have in having done that stuff at that, you know. Now, I never did the frog measurement. So I have, however, put a 9-volt battery on my tongue and noticed how it makes me jerk. So I think that's one we can still do.
Yeah. You know, he's the oldest living human, is about 120, right? So you go back to 1900, right? Nikola Tesla and Albert Edison and so forth doing things. And look at the brushless motors, electric motors that are everywhere today, right? And it's a classic example of the quantum leaps, you know, because back then, when the oldest person today was a baby, just machining the surfaces so you could have a metal piece of brush, you know, against a rotating surface with gaps in it so you could deliver electricity in time with the coils, the electric motors and generators working, that was the top of the science. Now, today, you have the same physical thing, but a funny thing about brushless motors, they have these little electronic sensors in them, you know, that measure the Hall effect. You look that one up. You know, they can tell when an edge of a magnet is coming along, and now digitally time, you know, the pulses of electricity. It's so much more advanced, doing the same physical thing, right? Principles end up being the same. We just, you know, again, we stare at it a bit longer, and you know, we stared at that for 100 years, and now brushless electric motors are as big a part of the electrification of mobility as lithium.
All right, two things to bring up. First of all, it's Nikola Tesla, not Nicholas, just, you know, because that's how I am. I just have to do that.
Nikki.
But the other thing is, you know, it used to be that there was this notion, and lots of people in my day, you know, had this, the science and engineering folks, you know, so you're on a desert island. You end up in whatever, boat accident or whatever, you end up on a desert island. Can you survive? Can you build the things of modern society and come back to where we are? And today, the answer is no chance.
Well, if you've saved the right YouTube videos on your phone and you still have enough battery, you know, you just get a couple survivalist YouTube videos and they'll walk you through it.
Well, no, it'll walk you through, you know, being able to eat the next meal, but it will not walk you through how you build, you know, another set of technology to get the Earth back to where it was, which was the underlying concept between, and now here comes an advertisement, Old Tech. A company I want to create someday when I get older, called Old Tech, that basically allows you to recreate everything we have today in terms of modern technology from dirt, and has all the technologies involved. And when you go to Old Tech, you know, to go to school at Old Tech, for example, you know, you get your degree in recreating everything, right? It's the and imagine when we go to other planets, right? When you go to populate other planets, okay. Maybe the moon, we can take stuff back and forth for a while, and maybe we can do that to Mars. But when you start to go to other, you know, solar systems, you can't really go bring more stuff. Right? Whatever you bring with you is it. And at some point, all that stuff you brought with you is going to wear out and run out, and you're going to have to be able to do everything there. So we're going to need, either we're going to have to recreate the technology from scratch, or on that planet, in that environment, or we're going to bring machines that can reproduce themselves from raw materials. So that's the other hope. You create the machines that can reproduce from the raw materials. You bring them with you to the planet, and they terraform, but first they terraform themselves and create the environment necessary to survive and thrive. That requires reproduction in machines. So I just thought I'd help you there. Okay, you're pointing, but people on the radio can't see what you're pointing at. You have to speak.
Well, it's a little Arduino robot that I mentioned in the previous segment. It is just crawling around the floor using its ultrasonic sensors to know how far it is away from things and obey the commands my son and I gave it to follow.
Yeah, another example of, yeah, that's great, but when you go to the next world, no, you won't have the ability to run that for a long time. Well, I guess if you can get batteries to work again, which isn't that hard, you know, salt water and a couple pieces of metal, you can get batteries to go reasonably well. But I don't think you're going to get solar cells working without some manufacturing capabilities. Just saying. Fossil fuels, you can burn stuff, create steam engines, make things turn. Should be pretty easy.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Ron Ross from the National Institute of Standards and Technologies is unique among those in the cybersecurity industry in that he has been in charge of the development of federal standards and specifications for cybersecurity since those standards were first started in their development. As such, his work has probably affected more people around the world than any other person in the cybersecurity arena and moved the course of activities in this area forward at the scale of nation states and global corporations. Here's Ron.
So I want to get to that long time ago,
towards today, because, you know, we still have 30 some odd years to cover. And unless you can stay for another 3 hours, we're going to have to move through it more quickly. At some point, you moved over to NIST for real. Want to tell us about that? Because I view your contribution to computer security through NIST as one of the largest overtime contributions that exists in the world. It's really fabulous, the work you've done over that period. So let's just start when you moved to NIST and walk through that.
Well, I appreciate that. I left the National Security Agency in 1993. I retired from the Army. I was just getting ready to be promoted to full bird colonel, but I decided to leave the Army before that. So I retired as a lieutenant colonel, and I took a job with the Institute for Defense Analysis, which I had been familiar with before. They were one of the FFRDCs that supported Blaine and his work at NSA.
FFRDC, Federally Funded Research and Development Corporation, a non-governmental, governmental, pseudo-weird sort of entity that in the legal system is bizarre, same as like Sandia National Laboratories and Lawrence Livermore. They're not federal, but they're not federal and complicated, right?
Yeah, they're there for a reason. When you can't go to commercial industry because you have to have a neutral opinion, kind of an unbiased group of people, and they're a special status. That's exactly right. So I spent almost 4 years there, and then I had the opportunity to move, and I said, you know, I love working for IDA, but I want to be able to influence things, and you can only do that sometimes from the industry, sometimes from the government side. So I took a job at NIST, and I actually took a pay cut, a downgrade in position, but I did see something at NIST that was an opportunity to take the concepts that I had learned at NSA and kind of push them out to the commercial side, the private sector, the unclassified side. So I came there in 1997, and I started working on the Common Criteria, which was an international standard that kind of took a little bit of the Orange Book stuff, and it expanded on that quite a bit and built the first international, the full-blown international standard that dealt with both security functionality and security assurance.
Yeah, let's pause for a moment to talk a little bit about the Common Criteria, because it's very different. The Orange Book and those things, they really specified here's the level and here's the requirement. But the Common Criteria really says you have to provide a specification for what you want, and the Common Criteria allows you to evaluate things against that specification. Completely right. Different, right? Right? You can be EAL, whatever, EAL7 on the Common Criteria and have no good security property whatsoever.
Right, and this is what I regret. We've lost a couple of generations of technologists, computer scientists, the engineers that understand what information assurance is. I think you might have coined the term information assurance. I've heard that it's attributed to you. But
also, in 1992, I did this study for SAIC, Science Applications International Corporation, now renamed Toledo's after the bad reputational hit. And it was a study with Ron Connect, who was the Assistant Secretary of Defense for CQI or whatever it was, computer communications, whatever, and intelligence. And it was called
Planning Considerations for Defensive Information Warfare, Information Assurance.
And it's about integrity versus confidentiality, basically. Right? The whole point here is we have to make sure it's right.
Exactly. Well, so the Common Criteria was able to bifurcate those two areas. Just for those of your listeners that don't, assurance is really important. A functional requirement is like, I want to do two-factor authentication. I want access control. Those are functional mechanisms that you build into the hardware, the software, the firmware, the system. But how you design those functions and how you build the software matters. So you have different ways to design. And in the Orange Book, you could have different levels of assurance. And that meant that you had to have greater specificity. So you start out with a top-level model. And that model, you would go down each time, you would go down to a different representation level, high-level design, low-level design, down to implementation representation. Every time you go through that translation, you have to have a faithful translation from the previous level down to the next. Well, assurance matters because it's not just about design, but it's also about testing and evaluation. There's different degrees of rigor that you can do that. Well,
we talk about assurance. A simple way to think about it is the certainty with which what you claim about the system can be you can be certain that it's true, right? It's how certain are you?
Yeah.
And so you can have a system that has these tremendous requirements. You know, it says that you can only do what you're supposed to do and nothing else. And that's great. So we've defined that, but it might actually, when you try to actually do it, not work.
Yes. Well, because insurance can be very difficult at the highest level. Like if you go up to the highest level in the Orange Book, you're dealing with formal methods and things like that. It was a formal modeling and formal methods is not easy. It takes a lot of time, and we couldn't do a very large code sets, if you will. So
correctness is what you were typically going to do, demonstrate mathematically that what you said is what it does. But it's not just that, right? Because, for example, dealing with covert channels and information leakage, it can be correct in the mathematical sense, but if it takes a different amount of time or a different amount of energy to do with one thing than another, then you can leak the information. So there is, in fact, no definition at this point of even what the list of criteria should be to make really sure, right? So that's sort of a fundamental problem we haven't gotten close to. Is that right?
Yeah, that's very true. And that so today we're left with, we've abandoned assurance for all intents and purposes. What passes for assurance today, it would make the old timers roll over in their graves, literally. And so
today, none of us are dead yet, so we're not rolling over in our graves yet.
Not yet, but we're close.
because medicine is improving quickly. And if you can get through the next 20 or 30 years, it might be you can get another 30 years. And after that, maybe another 60. So we can be spring chickens for all you know.
That's true. But you're getting to my point, that pacemaker that they've developed to put in your chest, Fred, you want to make sure that the code that's used to develop that is fairly high assurance code, right? Because I don't want to be able to turn your pacemaker off.
This is one of the things in my life. I figure, Ron, that ultimately I'm going to die from something like a pacemaker that gets a computer virus, you know, sort of my own words.
that would be unfortunate point of justice, I think, Fred, in your case.
Let's see. EAL 7, got to clean that up. Valuation assurance level. That's what EAL means. And that's the common criteria. FFRDC, Federally Funded Research and Development Corporation, these weird kinds of pseudo-weird legal entities that aren't government but are and can be trusted around the world as being independent, even though they're sort of not. And they can handle nuclear weapons and, you know, get permission to blow up nuclear weapons, right? You know, those kinds of things. And I worked for Sandia for a while, so that it's a strange sort of environment. Have you ever encountered the common criteria?
Oh, yes. Yeah, and all these things. In fact, when I was managing the Cisco PICS team, we got the common criteria certification. It was the only certification I would let us do, you know, because it sort of had to do it for some customer or whatnot. But that was the turn of the century. It was an interesting time. You know, there had grown up certain certifications and so forth. And it turned out mostly that it didn't matter if you wanted to sell a lot of security products to the industry. But NSS Labs was the other one. Actually, two jokers, you know, in the global team convinced me we had to do the certification to sell to the European banks. So NSS Labs and everything that came, you know, is still around, I think, today. Actually, I ended up working there a little bit along the way. All came out of the fact that Cisco PICS did an NSS certification. It's just fascinating stuff. You know, it's good to, because there's too many choices to make, it's good to have guidelines and so forth. And cybersecurity, you know, this is serious work. We need to get it done. I'm glad I get to take part in the transitional phase where you can argue things. I don't think in the indefinite future, people are going to be arguing the topics we've argued in our careers. I think, you know, 100 years from now, maybe we're done and it's pretty well how you do things, but we've all just been making it up, folks. And it's a bunch of smart folks and it's done pretty good, but.
Well, whether it's doing that well, I don't know, but his point about assurance, I think, is very important.
Right.
We have the specifications for what you're supposed to do, right? We know what that system is supposed to do. All right, imperfect, that's fine. But the problem is it never does what it's supposed to do in the way it's supposed to do it, right? I mean, I just this morning saw something about, I don't even remember what the initials were for this stupid thing, but basically somebody would take over a session that you had, a URL, a universal resource locator for access to a database or something like that. Well, they would go and access that database, and in the request, it would have their identity, right? Their identifier, your number 573. And they would just change the 573 to like a 24, and all of a sudden they'd be acting as user 24, which might be like a super user with access to everything. So apparently in these application program interfaces, APIs, in these APIs, they haven't done anything to assure that once you get authenticated, that you remain authentic. So you just sort of, you know, you get any access becomes all access. So people just don't think through what they're doing. They don't understand why they do what they do to be able to do it well. And we're not talking here about a minor imperfection that happened because some really complicated thing happened. We're talking about just the fundamental basics that I shouldn't be able to make a different request and win, right? You know, something I'm not allowed to do. If I just say, go do it, it shouldn't just go do it.
Well, you know, we like to, as a species, like to pick on ourselves for being really, really stupid. And to be clear, cats get through the world quite well, right? You know, understanding everything isn't apparently always required. And again, it's this balance. I love it. You know, there are times when you take it down to the metal, you know, or down to the atomic structure, and there are times you don't. And security writ large, not just cybersecurity, right? I think people, you know, we use words for these things. They're not very precise. But as we said in the previous segment, I want to be secure. It's like, no, you don't. You know, that's not actually what you're trying to do. And, you know, so whether it's business efficiency or one thing or another, you know, it's important to understand that, you know, wherever you are that's currently working is currently working, and it could be improved. Almost certainly, yes. Does it need to? Maybe, maybe not. It all depends.
Well, so the numbers of losses from cybersecurity, I think we can reasonably say, based on my limited attempt to verify people making the claims, is currently over $1 trillion a year. Well, that's pretty bloody significant, right? That's a significant part of the global economy. Huge. Just, you know, the FBI just, you know, got, I think it was 500, arrested 500 people around the world or something in this, you know, enormous group of people that were stealing, you know, whatever they were stealing by cyber means. And they totaled it up, and it's an enormous amount of money. It's like $3 billion a year they were stealing, which is, if they busted a group like that every day of the year, they would still be less than break even.
Okay. Well, let's compare it on some spends. I mean, you know, the U.S. spends at least, you know, $200 billion a year on the war on drugs. And, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, anyone, every American has all the drugs they want. So we can apparently afford to spend that much with no results. So,
well, I would correct you. Many Americans have more drugs than they want or should want.
Right. Yeah. Like my point is, you know, these are large numbers, but they're part of larger numbers. You know, again, the online banking thing, you know, early in the 90s, you know, we're forecasting. It's like, I'm looking forward to online banking. It's like, no, it's going to take, you know, everybody's going to have to, you know, carry tokens. And no, it turns out it's a rounding error, you know, at a certain level for banks. And they just, you know, put it down for operating costs. So anyway, my point being that losses are apparently acceptable, generally speaking, to date. In the face of everything else.
Recognizing that things are imperfect, right? Everything is always imperfect. We certainly want to recognize that. The other side of that equation, though, is right now the attacks against critical infrastructures are increasing substantially because of the decision by the attackers to no longer restrain themselves that way, and because the nation states that they work with and for have said, okay, go ahead. So this is part of that escalation of conflict. And we're nowhere near the top of that escalation in terms of disruption of critical infrastructures. And we're not talking about financial loss. We're talking about running out of water. If you're now Russia, who in the war in Ukraine is, you know, able to turn off the tap for water here, you can use that to extort us. And China has the capacity to do it probably. And hopefully North Korea doesn't, but they're working on it.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies. Next week on the Cyber Show, Pete got promoted as the person who stole the least. Rand's robotic rovers beat bi-static backscatter. Ron's vast portfolio changes the global face of cybersecurity. A pitcher returns full of fuel. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time, and bow. A good time, and bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time, and bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.